Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Today it's going to be a potpourri with yours truly. I'm going to start by reviewing a book that a colleague of mine sent to me. He actually sent it to me as a gift, and he said, read this book because it's got a lot of useful information. It's The Blue Zones. It's 9 Lessons for Living Longer from the People Who've Lived the Longest. And it's by a guy named Dan Buettner, B-U-E-T-T-N-E-R, who has founded Blue Zones, which is a website. You can go to bluezones.com to research the world's best practices in health, longevity, and medicine. He currently leads several projects across the nation to apply Blue Zones principles to American cities. And he's also author of Thrive, Finding Happiness, The Blue Zones Way. So he's really into this notion of the Blue Zones. And the book, it has two parts. It reviews different parts of the world where there's a lot of longevity. And at the end of the book, it tries to summarize the lessons that can be derived from these blue zones, these zones of healthy living that promote long life, and to extract kernels of wisdom or commonalities that you can apply to your life as well. So we start with Sardinia. Sardinia is, I guess, the capital of the Mediterranean diet. And unfortunately, things are really changing in Sardinia because they're introducing Western practices, but it's still a part of the Mediterranean, which has been relatively insulated from some of the depredations of modern life. And, of course, there they consume lots of olive oil. The diet is rich in fish. There's lots of exercise, and there's lots of family structure and religious support. And so, you know, clearly they exemplify one of the paragons of longevity. It's a diet that's essentially plant-based, relatively low in animal protein. They use some cheese, lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. They do a lot of hiking. They drink goat's milk. They are very respectful to their elders. And so, yeah, that's helpful because, you know, as you get older, and if they dump you in a nursing home, they don't have any respect for elders in certain cultures, like in the United States. And elders feel sort of left out and not part of the family structure or the work structure. And yet in Sardinia, older people are still part of the action, and they feel like they have a sense of belonging and purpose. They also suggest that you drink a glass or two of red wine daily. So this is controversial because, you know, alcohol for some people is the death knell. For others, it has artery scrubbing effects, and it contains beneficial flavonoids. Of course, olive oil is a big deal. We're going to talk a little later next month with an authority on olive oil, talk about some of the health benefits of olive oil on one of our Intelligent Medicine podcasts. All right, the next blue zone is Okinawa. Okinawa is also a place with a lot of longevity. I mean, people really live a long time in Okinawa. But Okinawa is also a place where the diet, relatively vegetarian, tons of fresh fruits and vegetables, lots of hard work, because many of the inhabitants of Okinawa are traditional fishermen or farmers, and there are a lot of centenarians there. And of course there they also have a lot of respect for elders. All right, and there's a real, you know, multi-generational kind of participation in the family. And so some lessons, again, can be derived from the experience in Okinawa. All right, you know, they used to say that it was the coral calcium that made the Okinawans live longer. That was part of the pitch for that product, which, you know, I find kind of dubious. Coral calcium, not really what it was cracked up to be, but it was thought to be the longevity secret of the Okinawans. Well, yeah, I'm not so sure it was that was the integral part of their health scenario. They got a lot of other good health habits going for them. All right, so the next blue zone in the book, Blue Zone, is an American blue zone. And I guess what they're talking about here is how you can carve out a blue zone for yourself in the United States with all the temptations and all the bad stuff. They talk about the Seventh-day Adventists who live in and around Loma Linda, California. And again, they're quasi-vegetarians. But the Seventh-day Adventist story is very much intertwined with the nut story, because Seventh-day Adventists have been the subject of research, and what they found is that Seventh-day Adventists who are just plain vegetarians but don't eat nuts don't do as well as vegetarian Seventh-day Adventists who eat lots of nuts. So if you look at the average Californian compared to a Seventh-day Adventist, they live 9.5 years longer, the men do, and the women live 6.1 years longer. And it is thought that they're doing some things that are heart protective and cancer protective. And again, he's beating the drum for a low meat, plant-based diet. Because, I mean, the first three illustrations, Sardinia and the Okinawans and the Seventh-day Adventists all eat a sort of a plant-based diet. Okay, so what's up with that? Next, we get into the Costa Rican blue zone. One area of Central America where they do very well is Costa Rica. And Costa Rica is a beautiful country. I regret that I haven't been there, but I know a lot of people have been there. It's really a beautiful place, and it's relaxed, and essentially the family structure is intact. Once again, social structure, very important. Plant-based diet, lots of fish, lots of exercise. You get the idea. So in so many different ways, he's saying the same thing, that no junk food, less animal food, and you'll live longer. Okay, next place on his whirlwind tour of the blue zones is the Greek blue zone. I guess a little different than the Sardinian blue zone, but in the same vein as Sardinia. I mean, it's part of the Mediterranean culture. And again, he finds, family structure and a plant-based diet and lots of exercise as being important. Also, drinking wine. He interviews people in Greece who produce their own wine. One guy, he's 100 years old. His vineyard produces 400 gallons of wine a year. He drinks his own wine. and he's doing fine. So as we continue our worldwide tour, the next blue zone, and you got to do this blue zone, is talking about the Japanese. The Japanese, I mean, Okinawa is, technically a part of Japan, but he also touches upon the Japanese experience as being an example of the blue zone. Again, a culture that still reveres its elders, has a place for them, eats a diet that is rich in fish, relatively low in animal protein, lots of vegetables. And he keeps pointing out the benefits of fiber and whole grains. So sort of a traditional message about how to live longer. And in the book, he has specific suggestions. And what's nice about this is it's not just about diet. There's actually nothing about taking certain vitamins or supplements. He's not a big believer in vitamins or supplements. But there's a lot about religion and the role that religion plays in longevity, because it's been shown that people who have religious belief tend to do better. I mean, that's not a reason to be religious. I mean, why are you going to church or synagogue or mosque? Oh, I want to live to be 110. No, that's a bad ulterior motive. You do it because it's important for you. Spirituality is an important part of your life. You don't do it because you read a book that says if you go to church or synagogue, you're going to live longer. That's somehow a little blasphemous, I think. But nonetheless, you know, here in this country, we tend to be very utilitarian. So you want to live longer, put yourself in a pew, and you will do better. So anyway, that's the message of the book in a nutshell. And you can read it. I recommend it because it's a great pep talk for a healthy lifestyle. Then I went to the website, Vitality. It's called BlueZones.com. And they have a test that you can take. It's the Vitality Compass test. And they also have tips that have to do with four elements in longevity. The right outlook. They think that's really important. They put up that front and center because if you're angry, impatient, hostile, bitter, stressed, depressed, anxious, it's not going to end well for you. It's actually going to take years off your life. The mechanism for that is high levels of cortisol cause the organs to deteriorate and increase the risk of diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, even cancer, you name it. Move naturally. Exercise is part of it, so that's number two. Eat wisely. Okay, that's part of it, but it's not the end-all and be-all. And finally, belong. And I like that idea. It's like fellowship, being in a social structure, being in a religious organization, being engaged in acts of altruism and charity. These are all important. So, you know, that's how you do it. The Vitality Compass test I took. And, you know, the reason I took the test is I'm very skeptical of tests. And I invite you to go there and take the test. And I think what you're going to find is that, as with most tests, it doesn't really capture what's going on with you. And so, with me, you know, I filled it out as honestly as I could. And when it came to, you know, are you ever angry or impatient? I was honest. I said, yes, yeah, there are times where I'm really, you know, I get angry, I get impatient. You know, I'm not Mr. Natural, Mr. Guru, Mr., you know, always at peace with the universe. I mean, realistically, I mean, do I gnash my teeth every day? Am I constantly, you know, having steam coming out of my ears? No, you know, but I'm an ordinary mortal and I'm subject to the vicissitudes of life, as they say. And so I'd honestly put down that there's, you know, some stressful elements and that I'm angry, that I get impatient from time to time. So in the feedback they give me, they say, I'm actually chronologically, I'm 61. So they, encouragingly, they said my biological age was 55.5, which I actually think it's a little disappointing because I actually thought that it would be better. But they don't know much about me other than what I put down in this questionnaire. And indeed, I wrote, for example, that I had smoked. They didn't ask me how long ago I had stopped. They asked me how much I smoked. And when I smoked a pack a day. And I just wrote that I'd quit. Well, the test doesn't have the discernment to know if I quit last week or if I quit as I did when I was about 20 years old. That's when I quit. So does that represent the same risk as somebody who's smoked, who's a 61-year-old who smoked until they were 60? They don't know. So they say my life expectancy is 90.1. Yeah, that's pretty good. That's good news. Your healthy life expectancy, 82. So that means I got another 20 years or so before I start getting sick, according to them. This very blunt tool that they have for assessing benefits or demerits of what I do. I think I gained a lot of points with my exercise, you know, because I wrote that I'm a frequent exerciser. Also, my height and weight are good. I also wrote that I'm free of any medical conditions, so you gain a lot of points. So they say, due to your life habits, your life has accrued an additional 9 years. Well, I would hope even more. I also wrote, and the test is a little biased in this way. You know, they ask how much meat and animal protein I eat, and I do eat a lot of meat and animal protein, but I try to make it organic. I mean, if you subscribe to the belief that saturated fat and animal protein curtails your longevity, then this would take away for my health. But if you're a proponent of the paleo diet and you believe, like Dr. David Perlmutter, that grains are the culprit, then this would be good. So what they say is also, they say, have some more grains. Have some more grains. If I ate whole grains, according to this, I would gain another 268 days of healthy longevity. But I try to actually limit my intake of whole grains because I'm on a relatively low carbohydrate diet. So I'm not sure if they really get that in this questionnaire. Also, they say pay attention to your emotions. Well, yeah, you know, I could do better on that. And no question that, you know, you can't afford the luxury of a negative thought or a negative emotion. And sometimes I'm there and I try to pull myself out as quickly as possible. But it's been a really gloomy winter here in New York, as you might agree. And sometimes you get a little melancholy or you get a little frustrated. They say improve your attitude. Yeah, anger and stress can affect your ability to accomplish personal goals. You know, tell me about it. Have a little faith. No, I don't go to synagogue enough. So I could gain 146 days by attending a religious service once a month, they say. Not 145, not 147, but 146 days. How do they know that? I'm not sure, but that's how they weigh it. Cut out the junk. Well, on the questionnaire, they say, how often do you have sweets? And I have sweets every single day. But my definition of sweets, I consider relatively healthy. Like a few squares of 85 proof dark chocolate is a sweet, but it's not on a par with having a ring ding or having, you know, gummy bear candies. So they didn't, you know, curiously, I don't even recall that they asked about how much soda I drank. That's interesting. But they asked about sweets and candy. But soda certainly is something that can curtail your longevity. Maybe they had to fix the questionnaire to include a question about soda. Also, I consume tons of vegetables, but I don't really consume that much fruit because I'm actually concerned about the carbohydrate and sugar content of fruit. So their contention is that I should consume more fruit, because I mentioned that I have fruit, not quite on a daily basis, usually one serving of berries per day, but not every single day, and maybe an apple, but I don't consume tons of fruit. So they don't like that. They say, enjoy some fruit, gain 37 days. Really? 37 days? I'm not sure if the end of my life, as the sands run out, I'm going to say, gee, I wish I'd had fruit, because I could have gotten an extra month and an extra 5 or 6 weeks by eating more fruit. Then they say, I wrote that I don't have any dairy, and I'm on a dairy-free diet, and actually I think that this is beneficial for me because there's some concerns that dairy may increase the risk of prostate cancer in men, breast cancer in women. Certainly, non-organic dairy may contain things, harmful chemicals. I'm allergic to dairy. I think I get nasal congestion from dairy. So I tried it, been there, done that, gone off, gone back, and I've noticed that I have more nasal congestion when I have dairy. So off with the dairy. And what they say here is, have a cow, man. It's kind of a cutesy way of saying that I should include more dairy. Dairy products play an important part of a nutrient-rich diet by supplying important vitamins and minerals essential for human growth and development. Enjoy 1 to 2 servings of dairy per day. Well, that's the problem with books like this that make sweeping recommendations, because the Okinawans, for example, that live well into their hundreds, they don't have any dairy. So, you know, it's interesting to read about the different cultures. But what you discover is different strokes for different folks. You have to find your own personal blue zone, what works for you. And it may not necessarily be reflected in this book, although this book can be inspiring and provoke you to better health behaviors. And so with some qualifications, I recommend the blue zones. And you can go to the website, which is bluezones.com, and find out more about it. By the way, here's the article that implicates milk consumption as a potential contributor to prostate cancer. The study is part of the Physicians Health study that looked at nearly 22,000 doctors during a 28-year follow-up. And so they note in the summary that previous studies have associated higher milk intake with greater prostate cancer incidence. But they wanted to know, did certain milk types increase the risk of fatal prostate cancer? So what they found was that the intake of total dairy products was associated with increased prostate cancer incidence. There was about a 12% increase in prostate cancer, and the amount that caused that was greater than 2.5 servings per day of any kind of dairy. But they did find there was a differentiation between skim and low-fat milk intake, because while all types of dairy were associated with a higher incidence of prostate cancers, the consumers of skim or low-fat milk were less likely to have fatal prostate cancer. They had low-grade early-stage and screen-detected cancer, whereas whole milk intake was associated with fatal prostate cancer, about 50% higher. So that is a source of concern. And the question is there something inherent about dairy? Because in this study, probably virtually none of the men consumed organic certainly not unpasteurized dairy directly from cows, because that's illegal in many states. And so is it how we process the dairy? Is it what the animals feed on? Is it the hormones we give to the cows, the bovine growth hormone that gets concentrated in the fattier parts of the milk? What is it that increases the risk of prostate cancer? We don't precisely know. But men who are at risk for prostate cancer, have had prostate cancer, concerned possibly about recurrence, might do well to think twice about dairy consumption. And we're talking about blue zones, places that exemplify lessons for living longer, looking at parts of the world where there's lots of longevity and good health. The opposite of a blue zone might be a red zone of disease. And certainly in the United States, we have red zones. We have some of the states in the South and in the Appalachia part of the United States, where there's a lot of poverty, have terrible health statistics, among the worst states in terms of obesity and early death are states like Mississippi and Louisiana and West Virginia, states where, you know, I guess they haven't got the health message for the most part. But worldwide, there's a big problem that's emerging. Diabetes epidemic hits Persian Gulf region. And they have an article about this in the Wall Street Journal this month. In the United Arab Emirate, there is, and in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, throughout the Persian Gulf, roughly 1 in 5 people has diabetes. And Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar are in the top 10 nations globally for the highest prevalence of the disease. Why could that be? Well, that's because of affluence, but it's also because of the sudden precipitous change in lifestyle. Probably in the last century, there's been an enormous change in the lifestyles of individuals in those countries, because they went from nomadic tribesmen in the desert to rich oil magnates driving luxury cars and eating in fast food eateries and shopping at supermarkets, where there's a tremendous abundance or overabundance of food. And culturally, they just have a framework to incorporate it or handle it. 35 million people in the Middle East and North Africa have diabetes. So you've come a long way, baby, you folks in the developing world, because this is a huge problem. And in fact, it's such a problem that they recently featured a story about a kid. I don't know how old the kid was, but he was very young, who I think he's single digit age, 7, I'm guessing, who is going to undergo gastric bypass surgery in, I believe it is Saudi Arabia, or one of those countries, which is incredible. I mean, that's something that couldn't happen in the United States because they don't let kids get that kind of surgery. But this kid was so obese and in such trouble that they said that he was a candidate for gastric bypass surgery, which tells you a lot about what's happening over there. There's an overabundance of food. They just can't cope with it. And we're, you know, they say that, you know, terror is an import from the Middle East to the United States. Well, you know, I don't mean to make moral equivalents, but in terms of the toll on the population of the United States or the Western world versus the Middle East, by far, the Western way of life is certainly taking its toll on people in the Middle East and in the, what we call it, the Mediterranean Crescent, that area around the Mediterranean, North Africa, Middle East, parts of the developing world where obesity and abundance was virtually unheard of. Now it's a huge problem. The good thing about it is that these countries are very rich and they're going to undertake major efforts, public efforts, to reverse this trend. They see it as an enormous priority. They're beginning to take steps to recognize diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease as national issues that require attention, not just from the medical side, but also in education, through efforts to get kids mobilized and moving. Urban planning will be involved to get people, instead of jumping into their luxury cars, to walk and exercise more in urban planning as new cities spring up all over the Middle East and amazing construction projects are undertaken. So we got to watch that part of the world because, you know, they are beginning to deal with some of the same depredations that affect Americans. And, maybe, I don't know, maybe we got some listeners in the Middle East. I hope we do, because this health message really needs to be heard. And I don't know, maybe I should open up an office in Riyadh. Any offers? Are there any wealthy Saudi businessmen who want to underwrite that? I'm just saying. Finally, there's a story that is making the rounds in the health news that I think really exemplifies the issue of health freedom and freedom of choice in healthcare. Now, I'm not sure if the facts in this case are highly disputed. So there's always a he said, she said aspect to these cases. In the past, we've had cases where kids have been remanded for conventional cancer care, and they have refused, along with their parents. Their parents have said, no, we don't want conventional cancer care. We want to undertake natural care or an alternative form of care. And these kids have been virtually impounded by the state to get what is deemed the appropriate care. And you know, I have to sympathize with the health authorities, because there are some childhood cancers which can be treated successfully with conventional chemotherapy and radiation. And as harsh as these therapies are, they can be life-saving. And by the same token, there are some patients out there or some parents out there who have very eccentric beliefs, sometimes deep-seated religious convictions, which cause them to refuse otherwise reasonable medical care. So it's a very peculiar ethical situation. You know, the state wants to protect the child. The parents, however, believe that they should have freedom of choice in health care, and it's a really sticky situation. So interestingly, I saw an interview with one kid who had actually refused conventional care. He survived his cancer, and now he's a healthy adult, and he works in a health food store and follows a healthy lifestyle. So apparently it worked out well for him. Hopefully it'll work out just as well for other people who refuse conventional care. But this new case is a case in Massachusetts, the case of Justina Pelletier. And her father has made the rounds of Fox News and The Blaze with Glenn Beck, pleading his case. And what he says is that his daughter had been doing fine. And then suddenly she came down with all kinds of mysterious symptoms. So this actually sounds like, you know, a day in the life of Dr. Ronald Hoffman, because these are the kinds of patients that we routinely see at the Hoffman Center, patients who have bizarre and challenging medical disorders, and we have to do some detective work to find out what's going on. It was initially thought, and this, she did not, she wasn't taken to a holistic doctor. She was taken, to one of the hospitals of Harvard Medical School, Massachusetts General Hospital, or the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, I don't know which, and she was diagnosed with what is called a mitochondrial disease. Now, most of us, you know, if you listen to this program, you know what mitochondria are. They are the powerhouses of cells. And we know that in certain diseases like diabetes or in Alzheimer's or in heart failure or in chronic fatigue, the mitochondria don't work so well. So we work to support the mitochondria because they're the powerhouses of the cells. And if they work better, they can make you feel better and you can overcome your medical conditions. But there's some people who have devastating genetic diseases of their mitochondria. And this is an emerging science, and it's not that clear, do you have it or you don't have it? I think it's on a spectrum. I think there are people who have devastating mitochondrial conditions, and they don't survive. They're just so devastating that they die young. There are other people who have slight glitches in their mitochondria, and they never achieve optimal energy, focus, concentration. They may suffer from mental deficiencies or psychological problems or a host of symptoms, a host of, you know, symptoms like weakness, fatigue, brain fog. And that's because their mitochondria aren't working well. And we try to provide mitochondrial support with a wide range of nutrients, magnesium, ubiquinol or coenzyme Q10, carnitine, alpha-ketoglutarate, and the list goes on and on of things that provide mitochondrial support. Certainly B vitamins are part of that spectrum of nutrients that can make a difference for the mitochondria to support energy production and thus overcome health conditions. So anyway, back to Justina Pelletier, the 15-year-old. Well, anyway, her condition just progressively worsened and worsened and worsened, and she was under care of a doctor who had diagnosed her as having a mitochondrial disease. By the way, one of the world's authorities on mitochondrial disease. Well, as the father tells it, she went back to the hospital, and they said, we're going to reevaluate your daughter. And they came to the conclusion that she had psychiatric problems, that really was the cause of all her bizarre symptoms. Some of them, you know, overtly physical symptoms, because she was losing weight and her hair was falling out and she was extremely weak. And, you know, it seemed that she had physical symptoms, not just mental or emotional symptoms. But then the hospital turned on the father, Lou Pelletier, and accused him of something called Munchausen's by proxy, which is an unusual diagnosis. But Munchausen's disease is when a patient goes around and tries to impress doctors with a bewildering array of symptoms that they cultivate and bring onto themselves. Sometimes the patients poison themselves, take harmful medications, cut themselves. They make themselves sick so that they can be the object of attention. Well, Munchausen's by proxy means when the family shops usually a kid around to get some, I guess there's some sort of psychological dynamic going on in the family that causes them to seek out attention or a misguided effort to help the child. So the child unwittingly becomes a part of this charade, and then the parents reinforce it. And then doctors, they don't know what's going on, but they make it sound like it's some serious medical disorder. So it just gets worse and worse and worse. The kid gets piled on different medications and gets sicker and sicker and sicker. So that's what they said was going on with Justina. However, the father is absolutely adamant, and he's going on TV blitz to complain that his daughter is being taken away from him illegally and against, virtually all principles of freedom of choice in healthcare, because these doctors think that there's really nothing to it, that she does not have a physical problem and that it's just a mental problem. They call it somatoform disorder. And it's actually really interesting because there's a whole legal and ethical battle going on where there are patient advocacy groups that try to push back against this diagnosis of somatoform disorder. Shorthand for that is it's all in your head. And I got to say that I see innumerable patients where they say it's all in your head. And yes, the mind and the brain and your psychological state, whether you're subject to depression or a psychiatric disorder, can shape how you feel. There's no question about that. But they actually have physical problems that got missed. So the way it works is sometimes if you can't find it, then it means it's all in your head. And so I think, I'm not going to comment on the fact pattern here because I am not Solomonic enough in my judgment. I don't know enough about this case to decide on one side or the other, to advocate for the physicians at Harvard hospitals or for Justina and her family on this matter, because I don't know exactly what's going on. But I got to say that there is a trend and a tendency for doctors and the medical establishment to diagnose patients with complex and subtle and mysterious medical problems as, basically being head cases. And now, the Massachusetts Department, it's coming to a head because the latest is the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families has filed a motion, for the father, Lou Pelletier, to be held in contempt. And why is that? Well, there was apparently some kind of legal agreement that had been forged between the family of Justina and the hospitals where she's being cared for. Actually, she's now at some kind of out-of-hospital psychiatric rehab facility. But they're trying to keep the parents away from her because they think that every time the parents go and see her, they reinforce her psychiatric problem. That's their contention. And the father is saying, how can you take my child away from me? I didn't do anything wrong. I'm just trying to help my child. This is terrible. We're not being allowed even visitation. They lost custody. They lost custody of Justina after she was admitted to Boston Children's Hospital last year around this time with the flu. And when she was admitted, they brought her to the hospital because she was feeling really crappy. And they then concluded that she didn't have mitochondrial disease, that she had a mental condition called somatoform disorder. And they put her on hold. They basically, I guess you could say they abducted her from her parents. And now she is a ward of the state. So this is coming to a head because they apparently worked out some kind of gag order that prevented the father from speaking out. And yet he's been going on the air appealing for the release to the family of his daughter and pleading his case. And the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families, the DCF, has said, you can't talk about this because we signed a gag order we agreed to a gag order that you weren't going to talk about this, and there was some sort of settlement. This is just a terrible, terrible situation. And I think it highlights, issues related to freedom of choice in healthcare. Look at this. Look for this story to light up the airwaves, because Fox is covering it. Glenn Beck is covering it. From the standpoint of parental rights vis-a-vis an all-powerful state, I think it really is a case in point of how in America your freedom to choose the type of healthcare that you want to choose is certainly being threatened. And I'm very interested to see how this case plays out, because it's a stark example of a patient caught in the middle of two conflicting paradigms. On the one hand, the father says she's sick, has a mysterious medical disorder, needs attention. The state says, no, she's a head case and she needs psychiatric care, and the family needs to be quarantined because they're just reinforcing her erroneous belief that she has a physical condition. There's no physical condition. She's got to deal with her mental problems. That's first and foremost. We'll see how this plays out. I'm anxious to see. All right, thanks very much for joining us. That's all the time we have for today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.